Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. This is Kevin O'Leary sitting in for Ian Masters. Ian's on a well-deserved vacation and will return next week. An occasional guest on the show, I'm a journalist and political scientist. My most recent article, How the Blue Wave Swelled into a Tsunami in Orange County, posted in the American Prospect yesterday. As a political scientist, I'm a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Democracy at UC Irvine, and I also teach at Chapman University. I'm the author of Saving Democracy, a plan for real representation in America, and I'm finishing a new book with the working title Reactionary Revolution, the GOP's War on the Founders and the American Idea. Today's show is focused on climate change, and in particular on the proposal from the left for a Green New Deal. With Democrats having indeed captured the House of Representatives, progressives are pushing for an agenda that will help shape the contours of the 2020 presidential election. For far too long, climate change has been a pressing issue that has been relegated to the back burner. For decades, the world's scientists and people in the movement have been trying to get the broader public to understand the relatively short window we have for dramatic action to prevent an unfolding climate disaster that could bring a new dark age. In 1977, William Ophuls wrote Ecology and the Politics of Scarcity, warning that democracy might not be up to the challenge posed when the advanced economies of the world press hard on the natural world. 8 years ago, in Earth, that's spelled E-A-A-R-T-H, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, a book so named because the author said the old Earth had vanished, Bill McKibben told us that climate change had arrived and was not waiting for our grandchildren. Last week, in the wake of the California fires and the dire U.S. government report released on Black Friday predicting that global warming could cause the U.S. economy to shrink by possibly 10% by the start of the new century, McKibben published a New York article about how extreme weather is rapidly shrinking the habitable areas of the globe. Often social movements and activism struggle for years, and then all of a sudden political calculations change and the dam bursts. Are we at a tipping point? Can alarm about climate change finally galvanize the public, and importantly, our political leaders in Washington, to meaningful action? How do we grow the climate movement exponentially? What set of policies can gain votes? Those are the topics for today. Today we will talk to three people leading the charge. William Lawrence is one of the leaders of the Sunrise Movement, a climate activist group composed largely of young people who 3 weeks ago sat in Nancy Pelosi's office demanding that Democrats move aggressively on climate change. Along with Representative-elect Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and other new members of Congress, Sunrise is pushing the Democratic leadership to set up a special select committee for a Green New Deal. There is resistance by the old line committee chairs, but the call will be made by Nancy Pelosi. What will the speaker-in-waiting do? The Sunrise group is organizing another Capitol Hill protest on December 10th. Our second guest will be Greg Carlock, a researcher in climate action policy and data based in Washington, D.C., and a senior advisor to the think tank Data for Progress. He is the lead author of the September report entitled The Green New Deal. And finally, Robert Hockett will join us. He's a professor of law at Cornell University with a strong interest in both corporate governance and the economics of climate change. A Rhodes Scholar and a graduate of Yale Law School, he is the author of a forthcoming book, A Republic of Owners. An advisor to Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, Bob helped Senator Warren craft the Accountable Capitalism Act introduced in August and was part of the team that put the Green New Deal together. And now joining us is William Lawrence, one of the leaders of the Sunrise Movement. Welcome to the show, William.
Thank you, Kevin. Glad to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to get together with other folks who are activists on the environmental side and put together a new movement.
Yeah, new well, to start, I got to give a shout to the folks down in southern West Virginia who have been fighting mountaintop removal coal mining for decades now for the impact it's had on their health, their communities, their economy, because that's where I originally got politicized around the issues of environmental injustice and started to learn how to fight back in my college years.
And you were at Swarthmore, so you were on the East Coast, and you went
that's
down
right.
to work on that
and,
issue? Okay.
And went down and met folks in central Appalachia. And out of that effort, we were inspired at my college to initiate a campaign to divest the college's endowment from coal as well as other fossil fuel companies. And that became a successful effort around the country that is now, and around the world, that has now divested institutions representing a total of $7 trillion in assets. But about 2015, moving into 2016, a number of us in the divestment movement, but also other folks across the landscape of young people organizing on climate change, started to feel that we were in need of something that could make a more direct bid for political power, because we believe that ultimately we need, alongside our allies, to the power to govern this country, because the ones who are governing it now are not are clearly bought out by fossil fuel interests. So we designed a new strategy and sort of went underground for a while, and then reemerged as Sunrise in early 2017, and we've been working ever since.
Okay, and talk about, so you looked at other groups that have been out there, you know, Sierra Club, you know, all the environmental groups are out there. What did you bring new when you looked at these other people and where we, you know, where we've been fighting the climate change battle for a long time, and people have been aware of it, but we haven't seemed to be able to get traction? Explain the new strategy you've come up with, where you're trying to mobilize more people and bring them on board.
Absolutely. So when we initiated the movement, we said we need to do three things. We need to continue to make climate change an urgent priority in every corner of the country. And a lot of these fires and storms are doing that job for us. Number two, we need to take on the influence of big oil CEOs in our political system. And number three, we need to elect leaders who are going to actually stand up and fight alongside us. Mm-hmm. And we launched with a four-year plan that went from 2017 through 2020. And, you know, it wasn't the smartest plan in the world, but having a plan at all.
That was a good step, huh? It was a good to have something on paper.
Absolutely. Having a plan is because, as you said, people are concerned about this issue. They're aware of this issue. But a lot of the political disengagement around climate change, I believe, is a result of just fear and paralysis. And that's what
Do you see that in particular among your generation? I mean, I've talked to younger people, and I'm the father of two daughters, and, you know, and sometimes the conversation will turn to about bringing children into the world, just given how scary it is. Do you find that among millennials yourself?
Absolutely. I hear that all the time. People wonder what kind of world we're going to grow old into. And absolutely, I know lots of folks who are reluctant to have children because they're afraid of what's to come. And so the anxiety is real. Any young person will tell you this.
Uh-huh.
But having a plan with steps for how we can actually make an impact is not something that a lot of folks have on offer. So having any plan at all, has been a big asset for us.
Well, let's go back to the three things you mentioned. I mean, it makes sense in terms of just kind of explaining to people what you're about, saying, you know, the urgency of the matter is here. I mean, the fact, you know, Bill McKibben just came out with a piece just after the government report came out about the dire economic warning of maybe losing 10% of the economy by 2100, which might get Wall Street's attention, you would think. And his piece was about how extreme weather is actually shrinking the planet, shrinking the number of habitable areas. So you've got the fires, you've got the great storms, and, you know, people start adding that up. And I would think that could be an issue in some of the red states, say Oklahoma with tornadoes or South Carolina with the hurricanes. Have you, as a group, as part of your four-year plan, are you thinking of trying to mobilize in some of those locations that aren't just blue areas?
Yeah, we would love to be, and we already are, especially in purple states. We organize extensively in Michigan and Minnesota.
And that's where you're located now, right? You're in Michigan?
Yeah, that's where I'm based. Florida was a big state for us in the 2018 election cycle. Mm-hmm. You know, Pennsylvania is not an uncommon place for climate organizing, but is a purple state as well, where we've been building. Mm-hmm. But just in this wave of attention we've gotten since the sit-in at Pelosi's office, we've seen people come on board in every corner of the country, really. Texas, Kansas, all across the plains. And as well as some interest from folks in, you know, states like Georgia,
And how's your structure? Do you have, like, I'm thinking, coming from the other direction, when I was a reporter for Time Magazine, and this was like in 2010, and I was in Arizona to cover a protest against President Obama and the Affordable Care Act, and it was right when President Obama was giving his second inaugural address, it was State of the Union, and it was the start of the Tea Party movement. And lo and behold, there's a group of about 30, 35 people protesting in Scottsdale, and one of them is a state organizer for Americans for Prosperity. And when we track it down, this is before it was really known, and we were one of the first news organizations that figured out that the Koch brothers were partially behind this. And their goal was to have organizers in all these states. Has your group been able to get financial backing to be able to put something together in terms of a 50-state organizing strategy where you could have state organizers on the ground in this place?
Not yet a 50-state strategy. We, as of right now, have 16 full-time paid staff. We've raised just a little over $1 million this year. We're going to spend slightly less than that. So we're very small in the world of in the world of nonprofit organizations. Mm-hmm. But we have always worked to give opportunities to people who just out of the passion and the mm-hmm. fear and the hope and all this mix of emotions we feel on this issue, we've worked to build a structure that people can be part of, whether they have 30 minutes to give a week or whether they have 40 plus hours to give a week. Uh-huh. So we have a lot of really, really, really okay. dedicated volunteers who work in some cases full time uh-huh. Because they believe that their future depends on it. And it does.
Okay. One thing on your second point, you mentioned about big oil CEOs. And when I was talking about this with some younger people the other day, they were and I was using the analogy of like when Winston Churchill was a voice in the wilderness forever in the 1930s, and finally people started listening to him, and all of a sudden he's stuck with Dunkirk, you know, and the Darkest Hour of the movie and the whole situation with his famous speeches. But he had – the point the students were making was he's got Hitler on the other side. So he's got the big mm-hmm. villain that's really a villain. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how politics works sometimes, and does it make sense to – say that the fossil fuel companies, the oil, the coal, that those CEOs, those boards of directors, they're the villain in this situation?
Absolutely. And it's not just good politics, it's truth. Uh-huh. When you look at these, you look at the documents that have been released, internal documents at ExxonMobil and Shell and other super major oil companies, dating back to the 1970s, their own scientists were aware of the fact that their product was driving climate change. And actually, in the 70s, they were doing some of the best science on climate change because these companies are staffed by them.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. And then within a few years, they started to realize the implications, and they shut that stuff down, and then they started actually funding an aggressive misinformation campaign that has led to the situation we're in today. In fact, these companies invented climate denial.
Wow.
Climate denial is not the mm-hmm. it's a uniquely American problem. People in other parts of the world look at the fact that, you know, 40% of Americans or whatever doubt that climate change is caused by humans, and they shake their head because they don't understand it. And it's because this is, more than any other country in the world, the place where there has been a, you know, $100 million or more consistent, decades-long misinformation campaign mm-hmm. funded by the oil companies.
Right, right. And is that continuing, or is that slacked off some?
It is continuing. You know, the bar keeps shifting. So uh-huh. at first it was what was the line? The line was originally that they wanted to create an aura of uncertainty and sort of fund denialist science in order to confuse the public. So first it was climate change might not be happening. Mm-hmm. And then it was it might be happening, but it might not be caused by humans. And now it might be caused by humans, but we probably don't need to do that much about it. And then eventually it will become, it's caused by humans, but it's too late to do anything about it. And the common denominator there is that they are not responsible, and we shouldn't do anything about it. So when future generations look back, these executives who have been making these decisions from the fossil fuel companies will be regarded as some of the greatest villains in human history. And I truly believe that, because the cost, the human cost of climate change will be tallied, if we cannot turn this around, in the hundreds of millions of lives globally, if not more. And that really does come back to decisions that they've made. And the public needs to hear that story.
And let's close that. I know you're going to have another, is it an organizing situation or a protest? How do you want to call it? And on December 10th in Washington, is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. So
let me just lead into that by saying, when you talk about the devastation, and there was a nice, really nice piece by Timothy Egan in the New York Times at the end of last month. We're talking about the wildfires and so forth. And in that op-ed, he said, 1 in 8 Americans live in a land that could turn catastrophic on any given day. And with that quote, I wanted to lead into kind of electing leaders and the politics of it. Have you seen is seismic change too much to say in the last 2 or 3 years on this issue in terms of people running for office and willing to embrace climate change as an issue that they're going to be working on?
We're absolutely moving in the right direction. You know, this election cycle in 2018, Sunrise, along with a lot of other organizations, worked to get over 1,200 candidates around the country to commit to reject money from fossil fuel companies in their campaigns. And
was that asking them to make a pledge, kind of like the anti-tax pledge on the right, similar to that?
Yeah, it was called the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge.
Okay.
We won't take money, not just from their corporate PACs, but also from the lobbyists, lawyers, CEOs of these companies as individuals. And upwards of 30 of those folks ended up elected to Congress, and including folks like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And now what we're seeing on the other side of Election Day is what is possible. We have representatives who are not bought by the fossil fuel industry.
Okay.
They do things like they show up and they join your protest at the presumptive speaker's office.
Right.
And
you're saying in decades before, too many Democrats were getting donations from the fossil fuel industry.
Exactly. Okay. Republican Party is completely bought.
Right.
And too many of the Democrats are compromised as well. So just to summarize for your listeners, we sat in at Nancy Pelosi's office 1 week after Election Day to send the message that Democratic leadership need to take this issue seriously if they want to continue to win the support of our generation, who were just responsible for helping them flip the House. And we were joined by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We were supported on that day by Rashida Tlaib, newly elected congresswoman from Detroit as well. Mm-hmm. Since then, we've had, in addition to those two, 17 additional members of Congress come out in support
Ocasio-Cortez's
resolution for a select committee on the Green New Deal, which has an explicit mandate to make a plan to severely cut our carbon emissions in the next 10 years on the timeline mandated by science and justice. And in addition to that, the resolution says the way we actually do this is by creating a public works program and a jobs program of the like that our country hasn't seen.
Yeah, not since the New Deal.
Ever.
Since the New Deal, right.
Which is why it's called a Green New Deal. And so we have 19 members of Congress signed on to the resolution.
And where's that effort going? I mean, do you think Speaker Pelosi is on that? Because in a traditional Democratic days, you'd say, well, it's just going to be the chairman who've risen up and are going to be governing the chairman. And you're saying, no, we want a special committee, because that will put attention on the issue and help frame issues and get the issues prominent so that they can be used in the 2020 presidential race. Is that right? Is that part of the reason?
That's exactly right. That's a big part of the reason. We know that we need to have legislation ready to go by the time that we hopefully take back the presidency and the Senate. We can't afford to wait 2 years to be introducing this policy in 2020.
No, you know, actually,
ready to go 2021.
Actually, that's really historically makes a lot of sense. If you go back and you look at the New Deal, and early in her career, Theda Skocpol at Harvard did some research on this. And if you look at the 1920s and 30s, and you look at the success of the Agricultural Recovery Act, not sure if I have the exact name, but the reforms that the New Deal put in place for agriculture, those were well thought out and they stuck, partially because we had an agriculture depression during the 20s and there were social scientists and researchers and political people looking at the problem, thinking about it hard. Then when the depression happened and the industrial sector went down, it was so sudden. And yes, Roosevelt didn't get elected right away, but there wasn't as much thought put into it before the Democrats got power. So the industrial side of, and it got struck down by the courts, of course, but it wasn't as well designed. And so it makes a lot of sense to try to get things out there, because the first year of a president is in power, that's the golden window. So if you have stuff that's well thought out and you're ready to go, that's when you can make progress legislatively.
That's exactly right.
So thanks so much, William. I really appreciate this. It's been a great discussion. I really appreciate having you on. I've been speaking
with... I'm going to say, Kevin, December 10th.
Okay, go ahead. Plug that.
December 10th, we're descending on Capitol Hill with over 500 young people, but supported by folks of all generations as well. Everyone is welcome. Who call on all of our Democratic representatives to back this proposal for the Select Committee. There are, frankly, no excuses to do otherwise. This is an existential threat. The science is with us. The public is with us. And now we need our so-called leaders to actually lead. So people can go to sunrisemovement.org/GND and find information about how to join us in D.C. on December 10th.
Well, thanks so much, William. I've been speaking with William Lawrence, one of the leaders of the Sunrise Movement, a climate activist group composed largely of young people who are working aggressively on climate change and pushing the new Congress to take action. Thanks so much, William.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break and be back in a moment speaking with the lead author of a recently released Green New Deal policy proposal that is generating significant buzz across the country. Welcome back. This is Kevin O'Leary sitting in for Ian Masters on Background Briefing. My next guest is Greg Carluck, a researcher in climate action policy and data based in Washington, D.C., and a senior advisor to Data for Progress, where he recently was the lead author of a comprehensive Green New Deal policy report. He also is a co-author of an article in The Nation, Why the Best New Deal is a Green New Deal. Thanks for joining us, Greg.
Happy to be here.
And I know you've done this report on a Green New Deal, and we want to let you talk about that. And right at the beginning of your report, which I guess came out, it was at August or September, but it's relatively recent. Right at the beginning, you say, despite the achievements in environmental regulation over the past 50 years, incremental policy changes and small shifts in market trends are no longer sufficient to meet the scale and urgency of the problems facing Americans and the world today. And I think most of us would certainly agree with that. So tell us about how this report came together and who was on the team that did it.
Yeah, sure. And yeah, I just want to thank you again for having me on here and to talk about this. I think we're seeing a lot of interest and movement, not only in just kind of elevating climate to a national conversation again in light of the midterm elections, but some serious momentum to put something real on paper. And I think that was the spirit of why this report came to be. My background, I operate out of a Washington, D.C. environmental think tank, and I do research and policy stuff in the climate and energy space. And this concept of a Green New Deal is something I saw in the Democratic primaries. I thought it was an interesting concept and invoking some of American history around New Deal transformation,
right?
And large scale investment. But I felt like some of the details were sparse on what that could be. And from my space, I work in that policy detail space. What could they be? So I thought what could be helpful is getting people to see that if we're going to talk about a Green New Deal in a serious way, if we're going to talk about mass scale investments, but also ones that don't make the same mistakes of the Green New Deal about not dealing with the economic, all the economic or social injustices, what does it need to include, right? It's kind of setting the table of, it's not just energy, which is one of the biggest targets that you often see in topics discussed around the climate change or environmental issues, just energy or air quality. There's water quality, there's land use change, there's urban sustainability and resilience, and certainly rural urban and sustainability and resilience. And also bringing to the fore the economic considerations, the quality jobs, and the justice considerations that have to go hand in hand with any conversation around investments in infrastructure.
Right, and it's a huge undertaking. And if you look back at the history of the New Deal, they were willing to grapple with this. And I guess, in a sense, we're looking at a massive transformation of the economy and trying to figure out how the best way is to go about that. One of the key things is always among economists is to say, we want to have a carbon tax. You talk about having a low carbon economy and getting to a situation of zero emissions or balance by 2050, which is ambitious but seems like it needs to be done. Talk to us a little bit about your feelings, your team's thoughts about the carbon tax. And if that's part of your situation.
We use the term tax, and there's many ways in which you can put a price on carbon, whether that's through trading schemes or through carbon fees or carbon taxes, which is a lot of, policy nuance. I first kind of want to say, we should definitely divide, at least I have, and we are dividing, spending considerations with revenue and taxation considerations. We have to, there is spending associated with this. We have to spend our way out to solve these problems. We have to make large scale investments. That doesn't have to be directly tied to raising revenue. There's plenty of evidence in how we operate today and how we've operated in the past about not necessarily having to pay for things and allowing the economy to kind of handle the deficit. And that's a much deeper conversation. And
in a sense, economists also talk about a carbon tax, or however you want to phrase it, is usually regressive. And so you have to watch out for those problems of low-income earners and helping them along with the transition.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that it can be regressive and not just the how you're taxing it, but then how you're spending it and delivering it back. And that some show that even just a straight up rebate is not the ideal way in times. Like, there are some offsets and rebates that you need to make sure that the energy prices are still progressive, but that public spending on investments to transform the economy is a much better trajectory to making sure that you're dealing with the historical inequities that are being put upon these communities.
Let me ask you this. What proposals in the past by the Democrats have you learned from in terms of both kind of the carbon situation and trying to deal with the various constituencies that have to be brought along to convince people? So against the Republican messaging, which is going to be this is, government takeover of the economy and it's going to tax people and it's going to lead to lower economic growth, et cetera. And working class people end up listening to that. So kind of a two-part question. One, what have Democrats done before, and what have we learned from their efforts before that you learned in putting this together?
Right. I would say, you know, part of that is, you know, answering the first question and looking at that, at the Waxman-Markey bill, you know, 10 years ago,
uh-huh.
predominantly focused on climate, focused on energy, and couched in this environmental framing with not a lot of, not enough, I certainly wouldn't say it wasn't a lot, but, you know, not sufficient amount of the constituency building around the other social justice issues that,
mm-hmm.
that are related to this. Looking at a cap-and-trade market-based system that a lot of people would view as, you know, people who feel left behind in the market don't like the idea of a market-based system and a system that allows the wealthy corporations to trade around pollution credits.
And in your Nation piece, you talked about how the polling has changed on this and people are more receptive. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And this was just one set of polling that was done in the middle of the summer, kind of the primary season, at the end of the primary season. And there's a lot of other organizations that do annual polling on these issues, and we cite those in the report. So I would also suggest looking at the trends of those over time to get a sense of how attitudes are increasingly, folks are increasingly understanding not only the reality of this, I think we're all to that point of we're not debating the science anymore, that this,
mm-hmm.
this is real,
mm-hmm.
But then also wanting their politicians, their candidates that they go out for, to have a plan.
Right. And I think for the Democrats, it was very interesting looking at the piece by Alexander Burns and Jonathan Martin right after the election when they talked. The title of the piece was How the House Fell, Republican Chaos and Democratic Focus. And they talked about how the Democrats under Pelosi had focused on trying to figure out how could you get right-of-center suburban voters and blue-collar whites, the blue-collar whites that had supported Trump, to come together to support the Democrats. And they figured out from their polling that if they focused on health care and pre-existing conditions, that that was the issue that would bind the coalition
mm-hmm.
together. Do you know of similar polling that would help your effort? Because you've talked about the different – and we can go back to this – five or six things on the environmental side that we need to do, and then how this does green jobs. Just talk about how, if you've seen any polling about how this kind of brings people together.
You know, there might be some cut within the data where there's some similarity. I don't, we could come back on that because there's the Data for Progress group that led on this,
mm-hmm.
that this was published under, is doing continuously doing new polling on this. So that's a question I can go back with them. But I think in the concept of it, right, you think
uh-huh.
about healthcare and pre-existing conditions.
Yeah.
Well, what do those kind of people, two groups that you mentioned, have in common? They're both people. They're all people. They're all humans. They have healthcare. They have issues, and they want their government and their insurance companies to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, they're going to have that commonality. And I think
okay.
that we can tease apart some questions about this in this Green New Deal context, right? You think about the climate impacts that have been going on over the past year and a half. That's an arbitrary time frame, but it's like you look at the suite of hurricanes that came through last season through Texas and Puerto Rico and Florida, and hurricane that came through the Carolinas today, and all the wildfires out west,
right?
And a lot of other conditions. You know, those are all people. They're red voters, they're blue voters, they're independent voters, but they all feel the same impacts.
Mm-hmm.
They're different income classes. They're feeling the same impacts. That's where I think you're going to find the commonality about, will this make their life and their home and their community safer? Will this secure their job or threaten their job?
Right. And we've seen the risks have become apparent with the extreme weather we've been having and the fires, et cetera. And then now you would seem to get some traction in terms of looking at green jobs and trying to kind of take advantage of this challenge that we face, given the report that just came out from the National Climate Assessment from the federal government, you
mm-hmm.
know, and the Trump administration buried on the Friday after Thanksgiving, and where they said, look, if the trends continue, we could lose 10% economic growth by the next century, the start of the next century, which would be twice as bad as the Great Recession, according to the report.
Right.
So you seem to have some traction with that in terms of looking at the economic factors as well.
Yeah, and the way I would frame it, you know, you're going to get this question of, you know, from the extremes of will uncertainty, will this hurt our economy? What will the Green New Deal do for our economy, to the extreme of this will tank our economy, all that stuff? And and I would argue, well, what is climate change going to do to our economy? Right. And that's fundamentally the point you were raising in some of the analyses that have shown that trying to put some number on the damage that climate change is doing to our economy and will do over time. And it all comes as much greater, orders of magnitude greater than the cost of not something that will make our lives worse, but something that will make our lives better, our economy stronger and more resilient. It will grow our economy because spending grows our economy.
Right. And people are starting to, now we've felt the impacts enough, enough people can see the necessity. We're starting to get some traction.
Right.
Greg, thank you very much. Really appreciate you being on. And we've been talking with Greg Carlock, a researcher in climate action policy and data based in Washington, D.C. He's a senior advisor to Data for Progress, where he recently was the lead author for a comprehensive Green New Deal policy report that we've been discussing. He also has an article in The Nation he co-authored called Why the Best New Deal is a Green New Deal. Thanks so much, Greg. We really appreciate you being on. We'll go to a quick break now and be right back speaking with Robert Hockett, an economic advisor to Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who recently helped write Warren's Accountable Capitalism Act that was introduced in August.
At least it's not the end of the world.
Welcome back. This is Kevin O'Leary sitting in for Ian Masters. My next guest is Robert Hockett. He is a professor of law at Cornell University with a strong interest in both corporate governance and the economics of climate change. A Rhodes Scholar and a graduate of Yale Law School, he is the author of a forthcoming book, A Republic of Owners. An advisor to Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, Bob helped Senator Warren craft the Accountability Capitalism Act introduced in August, and we're going to start with that. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yes, this is a provocative piece of legislation that Senator Warren has introduced. And I just want to start with, without getting into the details, what's just kind of the current impetus to do something about corporate governance? What's the problem out there right now?
Sure, yeah. So I think there's sort of a general understanding or a general impression that American capitalism has sort of gone off the rails relative to what it once was. So you might sort of think of this in terms of, you know, sort of where we were during the New Deal period and then in the post-war era. You know, during the first several decades after the Second World War, and of course in the couple of decades before it, I think I think it's safe to say the U.S. Crafted a kind of a new kind of capitalism, sort of a hybrid form of capitalism that involved the public as a kind of not just a rule maker, but a kind of a foundation layer for sort of what the general terms of engagement would be between various market actors in the economy and sort of large interests or groups within the economy, like the corporate sector on the one hand and labor on the other. And that in itself sort of laid the foundations for the immense growth of the American middle class. And
right,
at least
right.
30 years, at least 30 years of sort of stable, steady growth, sustainable growth. So there's a perception, I think, that's quite warranted that starting around the 1980s, 1990s, that settlement came sort of undone. Basically, the public role in the partnership between the public sector and the private sector was diminished or attenuated and even atrophied, whereas the sort of corporate partners of the partnership have, in a sense, you know, kind of grown lopsidedly large and out of control relative to the public sector and relative to labor. So one way of viewing the Accountable Capitalism Act of Senator Warren, as well as other bits of legislation that she's been proposing and that Senator Sanders has been proposing is as an attempt, kind of little by little, step by step, to kind of move us gradually back into that kind of balance that we had back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and even into the early part of the 70s.
That's really interesting. I mean, to think about it as kind of a rebalancing, that things are so out of whack. I'm impressed with what you're doing, and I read the Forbes piece where you kind of summarized the five parts of the bill. But before we got to that, I just want to say one thing that I'm aware of in terms of kind of thinking about this problem. Another author, Thomas Gehagian, his great book, Only One Thing Can Save Us, about the labor movement and what happened to it, and that we have to really fundamentally rethink how to get labor involved. And it kind of overlaps with some of the things that this effort that you're talking about with corporate governance, with using examples of countries in Europe about how they do things differently, but they're very capitalist countries, and we can get to that. So let me just kind of summarize from your really nice article in Forbes. When the bill came out, you said this would do five things. You said you have a new category of very large corporations that receive federal charters. It would be focused on these really large corporations. They're over $1 billion, right? Is that how it's set up?
Yes. That's right. Yeah, the focus is on the really large institutions. The thought being that they often, well, there's sort of two reasons for this, right? I mean, one is they are the largest employers, right? So when it comes to the sort of relation between capital and labor, right, this is a way of getting. The other thing is that oftentimes the patterns that are set by the larger firms end up being sort of followed or imitated by smaller firms.
Okay.
So there's a kind of a trend-setting role that these firms play. Yeah.
Okay. Then the second point was that you would require for these, you know, supersized corporations robust worker representation on the boards.
Yeah.
And say that no fewer than 40% of the directors would be selected from the corporation's employees. Now, that's not saying employees would be in the union, right? It's just you'd have a system for doing that?
Yeah, you can sort of think of this as a complement to unionization, right? If you think of unions, think of a union as an association of laborers that goes beyond the firm, right? That's sort of outside of the firm, but is represented within the firm. Then if at the same time you've got labor on the board of each firm, then you've got an internal source of governance as well. So the thought is that this gives labor a kind of complete coverage, as it were, right? There's a group, there's a kind of a unity that sort of transcends the firm on the one hand among the laborers, and then there's a role that labor is guaranteed internally in the governance of the firm on the other. That's often referred to as co-determination. It's probably best known as a form of governance in Germany, and as I think most people would agree, I mean, the German economy has tended to do pretty well over the years, hasn't really suffered for having labor on the boards of the firms. Indeed, these firms actually seem to make longer-term decisions. They don't seem to be as financialized. They seem to prosper more, and the German economy seems much more stable and less financialized than ours, partly in consequence of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like you can look at the German economy and say that it's a socialist country, which is the way, you know, critics would like to come back, right?
Yeah.
When you've got, you know, all these great corporations over there that do really well in the world market.
Yeah, the irony of that is, you know, when people are inclined to call Germany socialist in that way, then they really are committed to saying that the United States economy in the 1950s during the Eisenhower years was socialist.
Yes.
Because we had very similar arrangements, right? We didn't have corporate, we didn't have co-determination on the boards of the firms, but unionization was much more thorough and complete, and basically all of the terms of the sort of internal governance of firms were set by labor unions on the one hand and corporate representatives on the other. It's sometimes referred to as corporatism. It sometimes said we had a corporatist economy in the 50s, and what that meant was a kind of large-scale pattern bargaining between labor unions on the one hand and coalitions of firms or managers or shareholders on the other hand, and they sort of set the terms of engagement for the economy as a whole back in the 1950s, very much as is done in Germany even to this day.
Let me ask, just go on ahead with the points to help the audience out. The third point was that you would impose restrictions on the sales of company shares by directors and corporate officers. Why would you do that? Why that?
The idea here is that, well, so as you know, a lot of corporate directors and officers are compensated at least partly in the form of shares in the corporations that they run or options, stock options, to purchase shares in the companies that they run, right? Now, the original idea behind that made sense. It was to sort of align the incentives of the directors and officers with the interests of the firm. So you only prosper if the firm prospers. And in theory, that's terrific. That's a fine idea.
Uh-huh.
The problem is that it doesn't really tend to work in practice. And the reason for that is that over short intervals of time, share prices do not necessarily correlate with the health of the firm. You can artificially, right, you can artificially manipulate or inflate the value of firm shares for brief periods of time. And then, of course, you know, clean up if you're compensated in the form of those shares. And then subsequently leave the firm, and then the firm tanks because you only temporarily and, again, artificially inflated the share price, right? So there's a kind of a manipulation incentive that this has placed upon directors and officers to manipulate the share price, partly through buybacks, for example, but also through other means, simply in order to line their own pocketbooks. And what that does perversely is it really introduces a huge gap between the interests of the firm on the one hand and those of the officers and directors of the other. So what the Senator Warren's ACA, the Accountable Capitalism Act, does with respect to that matter is to say, okay, look, yeah, you can be compensated in the shares of the firm or in stock options associated with the firm, but you can't cash them in until a set period of time has elapsed after you've left the firm. So that way, your interests are aligned only with the long-term interests of the firm, not with the short-term interests of share prices.
So you could stick it out there 5 or 10 years or something.
Exactly.
So to incentivize them to think beyond the quarterly. I mean, you hear all this critique about it's just every quarter's profit. There's so much, and people who are the CEOs, they say, I've got so much pressure on me, right? That I have to do this. So what am I supposed to do?
Exactly. So it's a sort of an anti-short-termism provision.
Okay. Number four, your fourth point was about political spending. Explain that. Mm-hmm. What's that all about?
Well, so the idea there is that corporations, of course, have been increasingly the rules governing corporate contributions to political campaigns and corporate political expenditures have been steadily loosened ever since the mid-1990s or so, to the point where it's often the case that corporations are really spending millions and millions of dollars on particular candidates or to push particular issues or particular positions on issues that they hold. Now, the problem with that, there are many, of course, many problems with it, but one of the problems with it is that these rules have become so liberalized that the firm might actually be expending these funds in ways that the shareholders themselves wouldn't approve of.
Okay.
But because the shareholders are sort of diffuse and scattered spread out all over the country, they don't really have the capacity to kind of monitor carefully on a minute-by-minute basis what's going on when it comes to these expenditures. So what we're trying to do there is to sort of tighten up the sort of controls that the shareholders themselves have over the use of their monies for political purposes instead of for economic purposes like investing in real production that the firm might otherwise engage in if it's not playing politics.
Okay. And the fifth and final point has to do with kind of penalties or making, you know, having a hammer on the corporations, something about revoking their charters?
So the idea there is, you know, the charter revocation is the kind of death penalty, or it's a sort of a capital punishment that's sort of out there as a kind of sort of Damocles, you might say, right? So we say, okay, once the firm reaches a certain threshold size-wise, it's required to have a charter. And then if it violates these various provisions, which are best read as conditions of chartering, right, conditions that have to be met, then the charter can be lost, and if that happens, of course, then the firm simply can't operate at all because it's not permitted to operate without that charter. In a way, we do that kind, that's exactly the kind of regime we employ in the case of banks and other large financial institutions, right? Banks in particular are required to have charters, right? Chartering is required.
Right.
And if banks violate their capital regulations or their portfolio shaping regs or whatever, they risk losing their charters, which is essentially a kind of a death penalty.
Okay. So so you have some real clout on this. How does this?
That's the idea. Yeah.
How does this new idea of kind of policing the corporations? Is this a way beyond the debate way back in the progressive era between kind of Brandeis and Wilson on one side saying break up corporations, and Herbert Crowley and Theodore Roosevelt on the other side? No, we want to compete internationally, and large is good, but we need to regulate them.
Yeah, this is definitely relevant to that debate. This is definitely, and it's of course, it's no accident, I think, in sort of broad historical terms, that Senator Warren and Senator Sanders and other of the progressive senators are sort of thinking up new kind of cool ideas like this at about the same time as we see a resurgence of the old Brandeisian understanding of antitrust, which is that it's about keeping firms smaller rather than simply maximizing consumer surplus, which is sort of the wrong turn that some antitrust law lawyers took back in the starting in the 70s. So this is sort of part of that story. I think the best way to look at least the ACA in particular, is as being kind of within the Roosevelt-Crowley mold. It's saying, look, we're prepared to recognize that scale economies might be such as to warrant some firms being very large not being broken up, provided that we can mitigate the risks or the potential harms that are raised by size itself. And so the ACA is an attempt at doing precisely that. It's aimed at mitigating some of the harms or some of the risks that come from size in order to kind of keep the good without keeping the bad, right? So the thought would be, if firms in certain industries are permitted to reach certain sizes, maybe because the economies of scale are such as to render that a more efficient mode of organization, then we'll let them be that large. But when they are that large, they'll have to meet certain special social responsibility conditions, which effectively are the conditions of the charter that the ACA lays out.
Okay, that's great. I want to remind the audience we're talking with Robert Hockett, a professor of law at Cornell University with a strong interest in both corporate governance and the economics of climate change. And we want to turn to that matter now because he's been part of a team that's been putting together a new idea in Washington that's getting some buzz called the Green New Deal. Can you talk about your involvement with that?
Yeah, sure. So the Green New Deal is something that's been sort of forming for a while now, and it really seems to be kind of reaching a kind of a critical mass. And what it effectively does is it sort of combines two distinct and independently compelling ideas into one big sort of ultra-compelling package. So on the one hand, there is the matter of basically engaging in a renewal of a kind of really New Deal scale public investment, right? There's lots of public investment that has to be done in the country. Some of it is infrastructure of the more traditional sorts. Others, other forms of investment that have to be made are really not so much about infrastructure in the form of, say, roads and bridges or dams or what have you, but more in sort of revamping our system of education, revamping our system of healthcare delivery and health insurance delivery to see to it that, you know, we're no longer leaving behind, you know, one third of the population. So if you think in sort of, if you think of the idea of a new deal or a sort of New Deal 2.0, that's what that's sort of about. And it's kind of nicely captured in FDR's Second Bill of Rights, which he designed before. So that's
which is interesting. I'll just say to the audience that that was some scholars see that as a really, really important speech that's been partially forgotten because FDR gave it, I think, in 1944 as his State of the Union or second inaugural. And he came out with this kind of a second Bill of Rights to talk about an economic set of rights. And he didn't really want to have it institutionalized, go through the whole process of states ratifying. He just thought we were partially there because of the New Deal itself.
Exactly.
But these were more things we should keep working on. And we should think of, you know, a modern economy as his whole thing during the Depression and the great Second World War was to talk about security, security from fear, security from economic loss, et cetera, and that the government should help people feel secure, and this was part of it.
Yeah, that's exactly right, right? You could think, I mean, the Constitution itself, of course, talks about, you know, securing a more perfect union and securing life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all of the citizenry. And you could think of the Second Bill of Rights as a way of sort of basically furthering or finishing the job of providing that form of security, right? The securing of those basic needs that we all have and that you can say is the, or sort of constitute the fundament of a decent society where everybody is actually relatively well off or well to do and even prospering, right? And like you said, right, he said this is going to be the next big project in his speech in 1944. But of course, he died in April of 44 before we had just, you know, this is all projected for what we'll do once the war is done.
Right.
But he tragically, you know, died before he could do that. So,
how do we segue from that and that kind of idealism and that vision for society to the challenge of climate change and where we are today?
Yeah, so that the green part of the Green New Deal is the second great river, you know, running into this gigantic sort of Amazon or Ganges, as we might call it, right? It's the other big stream that feeds into it. So the idea is, okay, look, if we're going to embark on massive projects like bringing a job guarantee pursuant to which all Americans are guaranteed employment, are guaranteed remunerative work if they want it, and if we're going to sort of rebuild a lot of our infrastructure, which is, you know, as you know, has been steadily crumbling over the last 10 years or more, why not do it in a way that simultaneously safeguards the planet? See, and bringing that FDR's security idea back into the conversation, we say, okay, part of securing ourselves and securing our polity or securing our society is securing the planet itself, that is the fundament behind or underneath everything, right? That all of us of course depend upon. So, you know, there's just massive green investment projects that can be undertaken, mass conversion to use of solar power, hydroelectric power, other sorts of renewable energies, you know, mass conversion to new forms of agriculture that don't strip the soil of its nutrients. Basically, you know, new forms of sort of basic production activity and basic productive infrastructure on which all production itself depends that are themselves compatible with the continued existence of the Earth and the continued habitability of the Earth. And, you know, as you know, many economists have estimated that there's at least $2 to $3 trillion worth of investing that could be done in that realm, right? So that would be indeed a massive undertaking. It's entirely affordable.
And why is it affordable? How, I mean, that'd be the critics say, oh my gosh, growing the government yet again. I mean, we can see, you and I and others can see, it has this tradition from the Progressive Era to the New Deal, and it's not that we're getting rid of capitalism. In a sense, a Green New Deal would be saving capitalism yet again from going off, right?
Yep.
Then it was going off it was collapsing because of the financial situation, and you didn't have a Federal Reserve and all the things to help Wall Street calm itself down and not go on binges. And now it's, you know, world capitalism, just growth of all the individual companies pushing, ends up with the situation where we have not dealt with the externality problem. And the economists talk about a carbon tax, but we haven't been able to get the politicians and the public to understand, yes, we have to, if we're going to use a market system, we have to price things right, and so on and so forth. So how do you talk about the pay question, which you're going to get hit with about this is massive government growth, and the Paul Ryan types are just going to scream?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is, you know, we basically just have to laugh the Paul Ryan types out of the room. I mean, it's just absurd. I mean, basically, there's no case that they have to make at all here, right? So, you know, the argument that's usually made against something like this, against this sort of expenditures, it's either where's the money going to come from? Where are you going to find the money? Or a slightly more sophisticated version of this is, won't that cause inflation?
First? And that would be a good subject to come back to in another show, in the sense that Well, thank you so much, Robert. I really appreciate talking to you. We've been talking with Robert Hockett, a professor of law at Cornell University. He's an advisor to Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and he helped Senator Warren craft the Accountability Capitalism Act that was introduced in August, and he's part of the team that put together the Green New Deal. Thanks so much, Robert.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
That's a wrap for today's Background Briefing. I'm Kevin O'Leary, sitting in for Ian Masters. Thanks to producer Graham Fitzgibbon and board operator Ricky Herrera. You can find this program at backgroundbriefings.org, where you can sign up for email updates as well as subscribe whenever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. The show will be back tomorrow at the same time with Alan Minsky sitting in for Ian. Have a great rest of your day. Thanks. Bye for now.